Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Secular Foxhole Podcast. Today, Martin and I are very pleased to have Stephen Hicks with us. Dr. Hicks is professor of philosophy at Rockford University, and he is the executive director of the Center for Ethics and Entrepreneurship at Rockford and senior scholar at the Atlas Society. And Stephen is here to talk about his excellent book, Explaining Postmodernism. Welcome, Stephen.
Yeah, pleasure to be invited, guys.
Great to have you. It's great to have you. We appreciate your time. First, I'd like to give our audience a brief outline of what modernism and the Enlightenment are and what they should mean to our listeners. And then we can talk about postmodernism.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to start, because postmodernism positions itself against, you know, all of the major trends of the modern world, just as the modern world was revolutionary and positioned itself against much in the pre-modern world. So in short form, if you think of modernity the way historians and philosophers do, they look back to the 1500s and 1600s and say, intellectually and culturally, all of the major thinking and institutions socially were transformed. So, for example, Renaissance humanism, we can see it in the art, getting away from medieval art into the humanistic glorying figures of Michelangelo and others. In religion, there's a breakdown in Europe of the monopoly of the Catholic Church and its kind of hierarchical institutionalism. Protestant Reformation breaks out, and it brings, of course, a lot of unintended consequences with it. But one of its core themes was an individual needs to be able to read and read the Bible for himself and then increasingly herself. And so there's a transformation in how we do religion institutionally. Mm-hmm. It's the era of Columbus crossing the ocean and all of the age of world exploration. And so the economy transforms itself, and our understanding of our culture relative to other cultures transforms itself as well. So all of this is going on in the late 1400s and 1500s. But at the same time, philosophy is starting to transform itself significantly. It is the time of Copernicus in the 1500s, followed by Giordano Bruno and Galileo. It's the time of William Harvey and the discovery of the circulation of the blood. And so astronomy is being transformed. Medicine is being transformed. Chemistry is starting to wean itself away from alchemy and so on. And then we get the towering philosophical figures like John Locke, and in the generation before that, Francis Bacon and René Descartes, all of whom are arguing that individuals need to use their own reason to think for themselves in contraposition to what had been a more dominant position of trusting on faith, seeking mystical insight, or trusting various authoritative institutions to tell us what in outline one should think. So 1500s and 1600s are the beginnings of modernity. And then the Enlightenment usually refers to the 1700s, when a lot of those trends, things develop slowly. It's many generations. They mature intellectually. And you start then to see the institutional revolutions occurring. All of the science and the engineering and the exploration feed into what we now call the Industrial Revolution. The mercantilist top-down feudal economies break down in the face of globalism, and you start to see more mature accounts of free enterprise economics and in the figure of someone like Adam Smith. Mm-hmm. You see the political revolutions, first and more slowly in England, with acts of religious toleration, the extension of the franchise, then more bloodily in the American Revolution with its idea of universal rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and then also feeding into the even more bloody French Revolution. So political revolutions, religious revolutions, scientific revolutions, industrial revolutions. Also in the 1700s, the idea for the first time in history that there is something morally wrong with slavery starts to become widespread among intellectuals and thinking decent people in the formation of societies that are then going to start mounting a cultural and political revolution against the institution of slavery. And that is, you know, the first time ever in human history. At the same time, with respect to women's status, the idea that women should have the same rights that men do, the same access to the same educational and religious institutions that men do, and so on. All of that is, the broadly speaking, the modern world, and more narrowly, the Enlightenment. So how's that as a summary?
That's pretty thorough, pretty succinct, and I appreciate that. The three of us, I'm going to speak for the three of us, and that we hold the science of philosophy is very crucial, and the branch of philosophy, epistemology, is probably the most crucial aspect of philosophy. Do you agree?
I do agree with the first part 100%. The second part, I think there's some wiggle room for some argument, but I think I'm on your side on that one. Okay. First, about philosophy. Philosophy is your broad understanding of the world, who you are, what values you're going to pursue in your life, and how you're going to go about doing so. So your philosophy of life is important. And the reason why it's important is that we as human beings are thinking beings, and we have to be thinking beings. We're the big brained being. We don't have instincts. We don't act on automatic pilot. We're not particularly strong physically. We can't withstand extremes of temperature. We can't outrun our prey and wrestle it into the ground and rip it and fang into submission. Instead, the way human beings survive is by being smart. And that means that we need to think about the way the world is, think about our own capacities, think about strategies. And the extent that you do that well, and you do that in a big picture way, you become more philosophical. And the better your philosophy, the better you are going to be able to survive and flourish in the world. Now, the second part of your question is about epistemology in particular, which is the theory of knowledge. So why, I think I agree with you that it's perhaps the most important is to say, look, that we are smart or potentially smart. We have a very powerful brain potentially, but it takes a lot of years to learn how to use it, to stock it with all of the information and knowledge that we need for adult life, and to learn how to use our minds in very sophisticated fashion. And epistemology is precisely the discipline that self-reflectively asks us to consider how we are doing that, to learn how to use our senses well, and to cultivate habits of good observation, how to form abstract concepts well, to define terms carefully, and then to start to integrate our concepts into sentences and then paragraphs, and then to start to develop narratives and big theories about the way the world works, to use logic well, to use mathematics well, and then on the most complicated issues, to be able to think like a detective does, or how a scientist does on the extraordinarily complex issues that we want to figure out. So to the extent that we learn self-consciously how to use our minds very well, then we're more likely to believe true things. And then to the extent that we act on our beliefs, if we act on true things, we're more likely to survive well in the world. But because it's so complicated, and people can be lazy, they can be fed misinformation, they, of course, can be sometimes led around by their emotions and let wishful thinking and wishful feeling get in the way of clear thinking. It's very easy to use our minds incorrectly and thereby set ourselves up for failure. So epistemology is extremely important.
Yeah, thank you for that. In your book, Explaining Postmodernism, you name four postmodernist philosophers. Can you briefly describe who they are and what they specifically are railing against, if that's the way I could put it?
The hard word in your formulation is the word briefly there. You're asking me to identify four and then to talk about each of the four on a...
Well, you can pick. You can pick the worst two.
And not all of them rail against the Enlightenment. Some of them are quite thoughtful and nuanced, particularly in the first generation of postmodernism. But yes, the four I selected for my book, there are any number of prominent postmoderns, but the ones who have the best reputation, and I think deservedly so, are Michel Foucault, Jean-François Lyotard, Jacques Derrida, and Richard Rorty, three Frenchmen and one American. And they come to their postmodernism not all through the same track. So Richard Rorty is an American. He comes out of the kind of Anglo-American analytic philosophy tradition. And initially he was a pragmatist and then a neo-pragmatist, and neo-pragmatism, when you push it, comes out to be a kind of postmodernism. Derrida comes much more through the philosophy of language and semantics. Foucault is much more read in history and in Nietzschean and Heideggerian philosophy. And then Lyotard, and sometimes when I read Lyotard, I think that he is actually the deepest philosopher of all of them. But you see him deeply reflecting on Kant and then Hegel and then Marx and so on. So he's very deep in the continental philosophy tradition. Now, why those four? Well, all four of them are philosophy PhDs, and they are ones who established their reputation in the 1950s and the 1960s. So, and it's an important decade because it was transformational, that decade in philosophy, the collapse of logical positivism, the collapse of several of the schools of analytic philosophy into a kind of skepticism. But it also was transformational in the left politically, particularly the far left. And that's the decade of the transition from the old left to the new left. And we know the new left kind of burst onto the scene in the 1960s. And for all four of these guys, they were serious philosophers, but they also were serious political thinkers and activists. And so the ferment that was going on both in philosophy and in politics from the kind of the middle 50s to the middle 60s, they were part and parcel of that. But because of their intelligence and their training, they were the ones who were best positioned to be the strategists for the new movement. And that new movement came to be called postmodernism. And as the name suggests, it means a rejection of all of the fundamental tenets of modernism and the fundamental institutions of modernism. Now, the second part of your question there is to say, well, what is their criticism of modernism?
Yes.
And their criticisms are that the modern world and the Enlightenment comes down to three things for now. One is that through reason, we can come to know reality. That would be the first claim. The second claim would be that we should prize the individual. Individual agency, individual free will, and see the individual ultimately as the master of his or her destiny. And the third thing I would say is that the modernism was characterized by this belief in universal human rights, and that we should believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all human beings, and that therefore we should have some sort of liberal, democratic, republican / free market capitalist economy, and that will save the world. So those three claims as characterizing the modern world as then therefore the dominant kind of cultural philosophy of the last 200 years, their view is that view is either a failure or a fraud, right, and or leading to kind of dystopic, dysfunctional cultural results, and that we need to reject all of it and then do something else. And what that something else is going to be postmodern. And so all four of them rather will accept that general characterization that modernity and the Enlightenment have been a failure, and that we do need to do something post all of that. But then they do start to differ amongst each other in terms of what they say that post modernity should consist in.
Mm-hmm. Now, in reading your book, I can tell that even in the Enlightenment, the philosophers got the idea that our sense perception was an obstacle to consciousness or to gaining knowledge. And so there's a lot of philosophers that say that sense perception is invalid, but I'm going to just say it. Isn't there something truly perverse about claiming that human beings' basic tools, our five senses, are the obstacles to gaining knowledge?
Yes, but I think I want to say it's hard work in philosophy to get to that conclusion. So I think commonsensically, the instinct, if I can use that word, is to say, yes, there is something perverse there, but there is some serious philosophy that got us to that direction. Mm-hmm. Now, when we get into the modern world, there's all kinds of schools of philosophy, and what makes some of them are more skeptical and some of them are more enthusiastic about what we can do using our reason, using science, and so on. But there are many, many disagreements amongst the various schools about what reason is and how it works, whether it's based on the senses or not, and if so, how. There's very lively debate and very early figuring out, or attempts rather, to figure out how the senses work, how conceptualization works, how language works, how a good theory of semantics, how narrative works, how logic works, how mathematics work, and so on. But all of this is lively in the modern world. And what makes all of it modern is a very broad rejection of the idea that if we want to have true knowledge, all we need to do is have faith. You know, have faith in mystical insights that were handed down to some prophets, say, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Or have faith that one authoritative institution, say, the church, has a lock on the truth, and all we have to do is have faith in what the church hierarchy is telling us the proper interpretation is. So the widespread rejection of faith, the widespread rejection of ultimate mystic revelation as the source of truth, and the idea that we have to rely on our own minds is what characterizes the moderns. But then, since Right. our minds are so complicated, there's immediately going to be 20 different schools of how the mind works. And this still is going to be early days of what we would now call cognitive science. And we don't know how complicated cognitive science is. Hmm. We have to know something about physiology and brain science and neurology and semantics and logic and mathematics and so on. And you have to put it all together into an integrated theory that works well together before you've got it all worked out. So why I want to say is that it's not perverse initially, because I think in the early stages you did have philosophers who were modern philosophers and Enlightenment philosophers putting forth good faith efforts to try to figure out how the senses work and how reason works and so on. But they came up with early theories that had problems. And part of the jobs of other philosophers is to poke holes in other philosophers' theories, poke holes in the scientists' theories. And so for a while, what you see is early natural philosophy and early cognitive science kind of going through cycles where someone would come up with a new theory. Here's how the senses work, or here's how abstraction works, or here's how logic works. And then it would be subject to attack, and the attacks would work. And then by the time we get a generation or two later, people are in a more skeptical phase. Oh, that very promising theory that we thought was going to work, the Lockean approach or the Humean approach or whatever it was, the Cartesian approach, is a failure. And then I guess we don't really know what we're doing. And so we're groping around skeptically for a while until someone comes along with a better theory. And then everybody goes to work on that theory for the next generation or two until it ultimately, the failures in it seem to outweigh its virtues, and then we're in another skeptical phase as well. Along the way, you do have some persistent theories, and one of them does hold to say that our senses, this is the one that you're working on, are an obstacle to our perception, because one of the early theories is what we call a representational understanding of perception. And so partly this theory works with, this is not the only version of it, but it's a very prominent version of it. And I'm just going to lay it out there just so we can say, that, you know, these are not stupid or bad-meaning people. As opposed to, you start with a kind of mind-body dualism. You say, well, look, obviously human beings are animals, but we also have this mind, and the mind doesn't seem to be a physical thing. It seems to be a different sort of thing, maybe a vitalistic consciousness. And it hangs out with the body, but it's floating around somewhere in our head. And the way cognition works is that our physical senses in our body interact with the environment. And then we now know about nerves, and we're starting to have some ideas about the brain. And so what happens is various signals get sent through our sense organs into our brain. And then there's an internal screen that these images get projected onto inside our heads, say. And then what's going on in there is our mind then is inspecting these images that show up on this internal mental screen. And so what we have then is there's the real world out there. And then inside our head, though, is these images on a screen that are representations of things that are out there in reality. And our mind is not seeing reality directly. Instead, what our mind is doing is seeing these images on this internal mental screen and inferring the way things are out there in reality. And so this representational theory of perception then does set you up for the view that in some sense, actually, our senses are obstacles between our minds and reality, because the best our minds can do is see these images on a subjective screen inside our heads. The minds can't, so to speak, jump outside of our heads and see reality directly. And then if you start working that theory, then it does seem that that leaves you in a somewhat skeptical place, because how do you know that that internal mental image is in fact a good representation of the way things really are out there in reality? And then the various representational philosophers will try to get out of the problem, but eventually they will give up and say, well, I guess you're right, and then philosophy's in a skeptical phase.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm looking at a computer screen. I know it's a computer screen. I don't. Yeah. There's no filter or other.
Sure, but then we start to have the various skeptical philosophers that will say, you're looking at a computer screen. And suppose we had the video on right now, and that we were looking at each other. They would say, well, how do you know that Bill Gates and his evil minions aren't, messing with the internet and, along the way they are just inserting images, and you think that you're talking to Stephen Hicks, but you're really talking to someone else, along the way, since the internet and all of its byways and so on are so complicated, you, Brett, can't verify for yourself that the image that's projected on your screen is in fact verisimilitudinous with Stephen Hicks at the other end of the interwebs. So, and then we're into the Matrix and all of those fun arguments.
Yeah, I'm just going to let that go.
Yeah. Now, let me just say, though, the argument that I gave is a kind of cartoon version of Lockean philosophy. Oh. And there's a cartoon version that we can give of Cartesian philosophy that leads pretty much to the same conclusion, because both of them had representationalist understandings. And so they're writing in the 1600s, but then by the time we get to the middle part of the 1700s, a lot of philosophers are skeptical about those conclusions. And there we're into the generation of David Hume, and Immanuel Kant. And as we know, they are going to make some pretty heavy weather of those skeptical conclusions.
That's true. That's true. That's true.
Stephen Hicks, I have to do a comment there about when you said Kant. Wasn't it that the case that the only picture he had on his wall Kant was a picture of Rousseau. And could you comment on that, the importance of that?
Yes. Okay. Well, that takes us in a different direction.
Yeah, I know.
Yes, but that's a very important direction, less out of the epistemological issues that Blair's question have, and more into issues about ethics, human nature, and politics. And it is fascinating to think of Kant, whom we often think of as this stereotypical puritanical guy, very rigid in his schedule and personal life, and Rousseau, who in his personal life was quite a libertine, a kind of an in-your-face, that whatever rule you want to set for me, I'm going to break that rule. But nonetheless, there are some very deep connections, and Kant was famous for part of his puritanical outlook of saying, that I'm not going to have any paintings or images, and the visual arts were quite alien to him. There's an interesting speculation from some of his biographers that Kant came out of a strongly pietistic religious tradition that takes seriously the admonition back in the opening of the Bible that thou shalt make no graven images. On the grounds that you can't bring higher reality down to materialistic reality, which is what you're trying to do. You're trying to take spiritual beings and turn them into perceptual images, and that's a sacrilege, and that Kant is in some way heir to that tradition. But nonetheless, he was an admirer of Rousseau, more for his value philosophy and his political philosophy, such that he did have an image of Rousseau on his wall over his desk. Now, Rousseau was very much an anti-Enlightenment thinker. In my reading, he's the first serious counter-Enlightenment philosopher, doing his key writings, first one published in the late 1740s, but then on into the 1750s and the 1760s. Very much anti-science, anti-technology, anti-individualism, and anti-reason. So basically, all of the major features of modernity and the Enlightenment, Rousseau was against them. The tendency of the Enlightenment political philosophy was toward individual rights, separating church and state, free speech, and so on. But Rousseau was very much an advocate of kind of a communal tribalism, very much an advocate of integrating the religion with the state, and very much a kind of collectivistic authoritarian. So he was a kind of the bad boy of French philosophy, in that he ran feuds with all of the leading Enlightenment thinkers and attacked them. And so it is interesting that we find in Kant picking up on those themes and an honoring of Rousseau. Now, how Kant is doing so, because he's not strictly speaking a Rousseauian, and I think there are some respect for some elements of the Enlightenment in Kant, but there nonetheless is a deep kind of a collectivism that you can find in Kant. And a transformation of much of Enlightenment philosophy in a more counter-Enlightenment direction. So that certainly is territory worth exploring.
What? Let's jump back into Rousseau just for a second, and then we'll continue. It's been so long since I read anything by him. Was he the noble savage, or did he? Was that his?
Yes. Yeah. That's the phrase that's often attached to him. Okay. So he does argue that he has a kind of quasi evolutionary understanding of human development, that back in the early days, human beings were a kind of savage being, mostly isolated, that we basically just got together with members of the opposite sex to copulate and then go along. But then he does argue that for most of human history, humans lived in tribes, small tribes, maybe 50 to 200 people or so. And they were largely communal. They were close to nature. And then Unfortunately, we started to develop all of the apparatus of civilization. We invented printing. We started to invent machines. We started to develop property rights and develop all of the apparatus of civilization, the fine arts, the sciences, and so on. And from those times, Rousseau dates the decline of human beings. So we have primitive, savage, and mostly isolated man to the longest era, which is tribal man, who is still quite savage in large respects, to civilized man. Okay. And what Rousseau argues is, you know, we can't really go back to isolated savage man. But he does think that we can go back to some sort of tribal communalism, because that was the best era for human beings, both physically and morally. The human beings were physically tougher and they were less corrupt, morally speaking. So he thinks that civilization softens us, you know, just turns us into big, you know, tubs of blubber, because we eat too much food and bad food, and then we go to the doctors, and the medicine keeps us alive for longer than we should live, but also civilization corrupts us morally, and affords more avenues for corruption. So, what we really need to do is have various kinds of political revolutions that are going to overthrow civilization and reinstitute various sorts of communal tribalisms. And it'll be nasty for a while, and it will be authoritarian for a while. But he does think that we can recover our lost tribal communal identity and take human beings to a more healthier, smaller scale, more in touch with nature society.
I see. Now let's go quickly back to Kant. Many today, I believe, and for quite a while, have held him as the greatest Enlightenment philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Ayn Rand who said that Kant actually aborted the Enlightenment. Can you reflect on that for a moment?
Yeah, Rand takes a lot of heat on that. When my book was published, I've taken a lot of heat on that over the last 20 years for calling him the first figure in the counter Enlightenment. But what there's nothing really new in Rand's interpretation, nor in my interpretation, and I don't claim any novelty for it. Okay. Instead, there's a long tradition of kind of a bipolar set of interpretations of Kant, right from Kant's lifetime. So, as you point out, and I agree, in the literature, there are lots of people who will read Kant and say, here is a guy who is talking about reason and the importance of reason and respect for autonomy and the dignity of the individual and upholding universal moral principles and universal political principles. And that he did write this essay called What is Enlightenment, which sounds and does have many principles in it that are favorable to the Enlightenment. And so they read Kant, and that's what they take away from him. At the same time, I can wait on that. But at the same time, right from Kant's time, there are many thinkers of the Enlightenment who read Kant and see him as the all destroyer, as one of his contemporaries, Moses Mendelssohn, called him. Mm. It's also true in the next generation, Schopenhauer, who had a deserved reputation for being one of the great irrationalists in the history of philosophy, who read Kant and said basically Kant nailed epistemology and metaphysics. And if you are working the Kantian territory, you end up with me, Schopenhauer. And I think irrationalism is what we have to do in the next generation, the post-Kantian generation. Nietzsche, then three generations later, says, you know, as soon as Kant becomes the ruling philosopher, or Kant becomes your deepest philosopher, you can expect crumbling skepticism and relativism to emerge. Lewis White Beck, I'll cite him. I'm not playing appeals to authority here. We can go into all of the arguments that these guys made. Kind of the expert on Kantian philosophy was selected to write the entry for the standard work on the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, basically saying that Kant took the Enlightenment, all of its major concepts, and put all of them in jeopardy, which is to say, undercut them and subverted them. So from Mendelssohn to Schopenhauer to Nietzsche to Lewis White Beck to Rand to me, if I can include myself in that august company, there is a long tradition of arguing that Kant is counter Enlightenment, and that absolutely you can find in Kant some Enlightenment sounding things and some things that are legitimately Enlightenment, but those are all secondary or tertiary things that when you get to the fundamentals, he is subverting or counter Enlightenment.
Right.
So that's an argument that needs to be made.
Okay. Now let's go back to your book for a moment. You state that most postmodern philosophers are leftists. Why?
Well, I don't think that postmodernism has to be leftist. I think one way of getting to postmodernism is purely through an epistemological route. And I think what you can do is you can say, all right, I'm a serious philosophical thinker. I'm going to look at all of the arguments in epistemology, and I'm going to reach the conclusion that the skeptics have the best arguments. And so our senses are invalid. Logic is just a myth. Science is just wishful thinking and so on. So I can, without being a political person at all, just become a hardcore skeptic through doing epistemology. Mm-hmm. And on the basis of that, I can then say, I therefore think postmodernism has to be the right way to go because the leading modern thinkers are arguing that the senses are legitimate, science is great, human beings are wonderful, rational creatures, etc. I just think all of that is modern philosophy has reached a dead end, and so I'm going to be as thoroughly skeptical as I possibly can. And I do think that there are some philosophers who come to postmodernism through that skeptical epistemological route. Okay. Now, I do think, however, if you look at the most famous postmodern philosophers, and here we can just say, who do you think the top 10 are? Who do you think the top 50 or 100 to be? It is a striking fact that 99% of the most famous postmoderns are left-wing politically and pretty far left-wing politically. So if we go just to take since this is short, a representative sample, just take the Foucault, Derrida, Lyotard, Richard Rorty, and so on. Well, Foucault, when he was a young guy, by which I mean in his 20s, but a PhD, joined the French Communist Party. So that's a fairly serious engagement with far leftism. Mm-hmm. Lyotard was a Marxist, but a Trotskyite. He didn't hold with Stalinism, didn't hold with Leninism, thought that Trotsky had the best of it, and basically worked that territory his whole life. Derrida was more guarded in his political writings, but toward the end of his career said, basically my entire postmodernism or my entire deconstructionist approach to philosophy of language makes sense only in a kind of spirit of Marxism. So what he's saying is I'm not a doctrinaire classical Marxist, but I'm a kind of neo-Marxist or quasi-Marxist, or I'm in the spirit, in some sense, of Marxism. And that's the only way that you can understand what it is that I am doing. Richard Rorty was raised by Trotskyite Marxists. And while he was not himself a Marxist, basically he imbibed that. And on the American kind of political spectrum, you'd have to put him as pretty much as far left as you can possibly go, since there aren't really hardcore Marxist-Leninists in the American political tradition. But he's a kind of a far-left social democrat and basically a nice guy in a lot of ways. But so that the harshness that comes with the Marxism, you don't find in there. So the question then is, now, if all that's going on is you're doing some philosophy and you become kind of skeptical, you would expect people to be all over the map in their moral philosophy and their political philosophy. You say, okay, you know, nobody knows anything. There is no truth. So I'm going to be a monarchist, right? Or I'm going to be a libertarian, or I'm going to be, you know, a religious conservative. Right? Why is it that we find this postmodern skepticism allied with far left politics? And so one of the explorations then in my book is to say that the why it is rather that this far left postmodernism includes in it a certain political strategy with a certain epistemological strategy, and that it can't be accidental. And my argument then goes back to something we alluded to earlier in the interview, was that at the same time, philosophy in epistemology was going through a kind of crisis of skepticism in the 50s and the 60s.
Okay,
at the same time, it was going through, or far left politics was going through a crisis as such that the old left was dying. And something new needed to happen, a new strategy needed to happen for the far left, and that was the new left. And postmodernism is one of those strategies of taking kind of far left political instincts and marrying them with some hardcore skepticism and relativism philosophically to come up with a new strategy.
Okay. Now, in chapter 5, you claim that socialism needs an aristocracy, which I think is pegged. You pegged it. But I'm thinking of the annual confab in Davos.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Those people and their pronouncements. On,
yeah.
That make any sense?
Yeah, let's hold off on Davos for a moment.
Okay.
And just take the first part.
The aristocracy,
Yeah, socialism and its connection to aristocracy. Now, interestingly, you know, right off the bat, that sounds like an oxymoron, because socialism typically bills itself as a kind of egalitarian philosophy, that it's going to have everybody having the same political rights, but also the same economic rights understood positively, that everybody's supposed to have a more or less equal share of the society's produce. And so the idea of an aristocracy then runs against the grain. And certainly in the early generations of socialism, they were all opposed to feudalism, opposed to monarchy, and so on. When you think about Rousseau, whom we were talking about earlier, you know, he is quite forthright in saying, I believe in a kind of tribal communalism, which is much more egalitarian. Marx and Engels, when they're talking about communism, they don't say a whole lot about the way it's going to go, but it is going to be, sort of everybody's going to have a distribution according to their needs. And if human beings' needs are more or less equal, everybody's going to get pretty much the same amount of stuff. Now, where the connection to aristocracy starts to come in is with the kind of the new versions of Rousseauianism and the new versions of Marxism that start to crop up by the time we get to the turn of the 20th century, because the idea that somehow we can have a revolution easily against the remaining monarchies and against the remaining aristocracies, against the new versions of capitalism, that in some sense the socialist revolution is going to rise up, the working people, the peasants, and so forth, the serfs are going to rise up, overthrow all of their masters, and then institute a communal society. People start to get impatient among the far left by the time we get to around 1900 or so. It doesn't seem like the working classes, the peasants, and so on are getting their act together. So what you start to see is new forms of Rousseauian socialism and new forms of Marxist socialism saying what we need is a kind of leadership people who are going to be well-trained in socialist theory, but also well-trained in how to do a revolution, activists. And on behalf of the masses, on behalf of the peasants, they will assume leadership in the movement and they will effect the revolution. And so Marxist Leninism, for example, is one such new Marxism that we can't just wait around for the working classes to rise up. Instead, it's going to take a small cadre of specially trained revolutionaries, Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, and the Bolsheviks, to assume a kind of dictatorial power to make the revolution happen, and at least for the first generation to be dictatorships. And so that's a kind of aristocracy that we are talking about. They will have special rights and powers that the broad masses won't have. Now, in England, the Fabian socialists were very similar. Sidney and Beatrice Webb, George Bernard Shaw, John Maynard Keynes flirted with them. And I think it's fair to say that he's actually a kind of Fabian socialist, although he's a little more interventionist. We can argue about whether it's fair to put him in that group or not. Where, again, they're quite saying basically the working classes, they're looking at the English, are too concerned with football, English-style football, with drinking. They're too illiterate and frankly, unwashed. We're never going to get a revolution out of those people. Instead, it's going to be sophisticated people like us, like the Webbs and so on, who are going to, on behalf of the working masses, find a way to forge the revolution. And it's not going to be quite as bloody as the Germans and the Russians are talking about, because we are British after all. But nonetheless, we are the aristocracy that socialism needs, and we will be the leadership to bring about the new socialist society. So that is characteristic of much of 20th century socialism. And that's also partly why you start to see it become less a movement in the trade unions, less a movement of trying to organize the peasants, and you start to see it move into the universities where it's intellectuals who know that they're pretty smart. They can read their Marx, they can read their Gramsci, they can read the Frankfurt School and come up with the sophisticated theories. And it's all of these university-trained intellectuals who are seeing themselves as the new breed of revolutionaries who are going to make the new society happen on behalf of the masses, but it's not going to come from the masses.
Okay. All right. So you don't think then that the people at Davos are...
Yeah, well, okay. Socialism, I want to say, is a very big tent.
Yes, it is. Yes,
you know, you look at, you say, what's conservatism? What's libertarianism? And so on. And there we can get into all kinds of taxonomy arguments about genus and species and so on. So I think you're probably right to say that, and here is my taxonomy. I would say at the highest level, socialism contrasts to individualism. So When you are doing your social and political philosophy, what is your fundamental unit of value? Is it the individual or is it some sort of social grouping? If you believe fundamentally in the value of the individual and individual rights, then you're going to be an individualist. But then there are going to be lots of different kinds of individualist philosophy, all of the classical liberal schools, including the libertarians, including many people who are now conservatives, including many people who are just pure free market economists, many people who don't care a lot about economics, but are hardcore religious individualists, and so on. Okay. All of those are going to be individualists because for them, the sanctity of the individual is their fundamental value. If, by contrast, your fundamental social and political value is a social group, then you are going to be a socialist in some form. But then you have to ask, well, what is the most important social group? And then there are going to be people who will say, we think it is the economic groupings that are most fundamental. And that's going to be the Marxists and all of their offshoots. But equally so, there are going to be socialists who are going to say economics are important, but really it's one's ethnic group that is the most important social grouping. And so various forms of ethno-socialism and national-based socialism are going to be more important. And they will say, you know, maybe we can borrow some things from the economic socialists, but really we're interested in our ethnic group. There are going to be people who are racial socialists who think that there is something to biological race, and they're going to be arguing that different racial groups and that your identity as a member of a racial group is most important. And so racial socialisms come to be important. I think also there can be various forms of family socialism, that what you should do is not see yourself as an individual or as the family, as a network for mutual support of individuals in the family, but really the individuals exist to serve the family and to make the family. And then the family might be narrowly or more broadly conceived, but you exist to serve the family unit. And that's a kind of family socialism. So in that mix, of course, fascism has to be put, because
yes.
You have Mussolini and Gentile and Rocco and all of the theoreticians of fascism are clearly anti-individualistic. And in their own way, they are mixing nationalism with ethnocentrism, with a little bit of economic socialism as well, into a theoretical and activist outlook. So out of that mix, definitely, I would say, when you then march down a couple of generations later and you are talking about some of the people who are, the 800-pound gorillas at Davos, some of them are fascists for sure. And that when you nail them down to their 10-point programs, whatever those are, they would have strong agreement with the classical program coming out of Mussolini and Gentile. Some of them, I think, would be closer to a Rousseauian program. Some of them would be closer to a neo-Marxist program. So where exactly in the taxonomy you put the Davos, that's already a pretty big tent itself, I think, would be up for grabs.
Okay. Oh, well, that's a very good explanation of those people, though. Thank you. Yeah. Now, I've heard my whole life that capitalism is the cause of war and strife all around the world. I wholeheartedly deny that. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. I agree with you right on that. I think one way to look at it is initially empirically. One question would be to say, if you say take two countries, say France and Great Britain, and if you ask when was the last time the two of them fought a war against each other. And you have to say, basically, it's been over 200 years. The last time they fought a war against each other was the Napoleonic War, which ended in 1815. And Napoleon was a kind of dictator, a nationalist dictator. And at that point, Britain was a kind of quasi-monarchy, quasi-aristocracy, democratic capitalist nation as well. But basically, for the last 200 years, France has been a kind of democratic capitalist nation, a republic, and Great Britain has been a democratic capitalist nation, different flavors in various ways. But since they became capitalists, they don't fight wars against each other. And that is true when you look at the nations that are capitalists. So I'm originally from Canada. And now I'm living in the United States, and we might say, well, when was the last time Canada, a kind of democratic capitalist nation, and the United States, a more Republican capitalist nation, when was the last time Canada and the U.S. went to war? And then we go back to, well, basically never.
Yeah, exactly.
The country in 1867, the last time there was a war was 1812, and that was when Canada was really a set of colonies still under Britain. There were still a lot of hard feelings between Britain and the U.S. Over the War of Independence and so on. And also in 1812, there's the war against Napoleon and the French going on. And it's not clear whether the Americans are going to be more supportive of the French or the British. And so the geopolitics is complicated at that time. But basically, Canada, democratic capitalist, U.S., Republican capitalists, they don't fight wars. When you go through and you look at it, the capitalist countries don't fight wars against each other because they trade with each other. And that's the whole ethos of capitalism. The whole ethos of capitalism is you respect individual freedom. You make stuff. You take responsibility for your life. And if you want to get rich, you get rich by making really quality stuff and trading with people. And capitalism is tied in with globalism. You want to have the biggest market you can. And so you have all of these international capitalist networks where your supplies are coming from one country, you're manufacturing in your own country, and then you're exporting to other countries where your customer base is. Now, what that then means is if you want to get rich, you need to have peaceful relationships with the countries that are your vendors. You don't want to go to war because as soon as you go to war, you can't get your raw materials anymore. All of the trading network get disrupted. As soon as you go to war with the country where you're getting millions of dollars from customers in that country, then you're losing millions of dollars because trade gets cut off from your customers. So capitalists, 99% of them in the country, they are always the ones who are saying, no, let's not go to war. Now, where I think the argument gets some traction is, and the way that people typically think about it is they want to say, well, one of the traditional reasons for going to war is a kind of greed. Right? You see that other people have stuff, you want their stuff, and the easiest way to get their stuff is to attack them and try to take their stuff. And so you adopt a predatory mode of trying to get rich. And that, of course, is partly characteristic of a lot of wars in human history. But what's interesting is that all of that human history is prior to the birth of capitalism in the modern world. And what happens when you get to capitalism is it says, yes, be greedy, be an individual. But if you really are going to be an effective greed-based person, a profit-based person, the way you're going to do that is by not by predation, but by being really good at making quality stuff. And then the whole ethos of capitalism is we need to respect individual rights to life, liberty, property, and so on. And so the whole legal system of capitalism is based on enshrining rights. And that means that you can't legitimately under capitalism, attack people and try to kill them. That violates their right to life. And the institutions of capitalism stop you from doing so. If you try to take their stuff, the institution of capitalism says, no, you're violating their property rights, and it tries to stop you from doing so. So empirically and theoretically, capitalism is the most peace-loving system that has been devised.
Yes, thank you. We've bumped up against the hour, but I still have like three or four more questions I'd love to get in, if you don't mind.
I think I have time for one more, if you don't mind. I am open to follow up in some month's time, maybe toward the end of this semester. You really do have a lot of good questions. And
I guess I scared you with the 7 pages I first sent you.
and Blair, then yes. I will, cut. You could have your questions, but please say something about the extra material that was in the audiobook about the freedom of speech.
Yes.
Get that in somehow.
Let's do the freedom of speech and the critique of your critique of the art world. That's in the expanded edition of your book.
Okay.
And then we'll wrap it up.
All right. Sounds good.
Please. All right.
How would you like to formulate the question?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Let's see. Well, what are the tools that we already have and can use to properly defend free speech?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a big one. I think the main tool that we have is that we still have a broadly liberal culture, a broadly individualist culture, where I think most people and most intellectuals recognize that people need to think for themselves, that there's something paternalistic about telling anybody that certain views they can't be exposed to. or that they're not allowed to say certain things, or that they shouldn't be able to read certain books and movies and so on, that that they are tough-minded enough to be able to hear criticisms, to be exposed to stuff that might offend them, and that they need in their lives to be able to explore on their own. I think that's still a significant part of our culture, and that's probably our strongest asset. I think our other important asset, though, is that we do have a now waking up intellectual class to the threat that the new forms of censorship pose. And I think we had a good run for a good century or so where liberal, in the best sense of that word, attitudes toward free speech and anti-censorship became our dominant ethos, both individually and politically, that we had strong protections for academic freedom, that routinely laws enacting forms of censorship got slapped down through judicial review. But we then started to be rather complacent for a couple of generations, and that allowed the new generation of censors, many of them coming out of postmodernism, who just want to do power politics. They don't have arguments. They just believe in trying to ram their values down your throat by any value or means possible, and censorship is a good way of doing so. Yeah. And many of them are just operating in concert with people who are not sophisticated postmodernists, but just kind of old-fashioned censors. You know, they have their agenda, they have their beliefs, they have their values. They don't want to have to be bothered to argue for them, that they will take the short run censorship tool and use those censorship tools whenever they possibly can. But they have been unleashed on many university campuses and in some sectors of our culture. But I do think in the last 10 years or so, I would say especially in the last 7 years, and here I want to give a lot of props to Jordan Peterson, to Jonathan Haidt, to Steven Pinker, who are all first-rate intellectuals. Yes. You know, they disagree with each other on all sorts of political and cultural issues, but they are all very strong on academic freedom and free speech. That all of them stepped up, starting 6-7 years ago, recognizing that there is something rotten inside the academic world and that something needed to be done. So they're first-rate guys, and they've attracted lots of other first-rate people who are fighting now the good fight inside the academic world and in various other cultural sectors, the art world, business sector, political sector, religion sector, family law, and so on. So the fight is joined, and I think we're going to win. But I think it's going to be ugly. It has been ugly, and I think it'll continue to be ugly for a little while. But we've got the best arguments, and I think we still have a good sense of life and a good cultural ethos in much of Western civilization, increasingly around the world. So the better arguments and the better ethics, I think, will prevail.
Very good, sir. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Hey, a real pleasure. That hour did fly by. But yeah, let me get through to the end of my semester, which will be in December. And then maybe let's have a round of email and set up a follow-up discussion for the rest of your very good questions.
Oh, well, all right. I'll pick some more then.
Yeah.
I'll pick a few more. But I always end my show with our guest. I say, Stephen, thank you for manning the foxhole with us today.
Fun line. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Take care, Stephen. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.